Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Yes, thank you. You got it right. Physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time A-level mostly teacher of physics.
And physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a full-time teacher of physics all the way from year 8 through to year 13, which is presumably why I can never remember the intro properly, but there we go.
And we are joined today by a special guest. Thank you very much for joining us at very short notice, Rajani Nair.
Hello, thank you. I'm happy to be here. My name is Rajani Nair and I work as a physics teacher in a school in Sutton Cheam. It's a girls' school.
So Rajani has joined us and it's quite interesting because she replied to a tweet that was retweeted to her by a friend. She'd never heard of the podcast and has never heard an episode. So she's here. She's learning as she goes. I've already failed to press start recording once, so she knows a little bit about how it works. But today we're going to talk about required practicals. It's a 5N+3 and we're going to do A-level required practicals. And the one Rajani has chosen is a specific heat capacity. Which is interesting because it's not a required one in my spec AQA, but I think it is in yours, Rajani. Which did you say you are? Your
OCRA.
OCRA. And Robin, you're EdXL.
Yeah, it's not required in my one, but it's one that I never miss because I always think it is a great practical. And doing this one and comparing it with the liquid specific capacity afterwards is really nice.
Okay, so without further ado, Rajani, how do you do specific heat capacity with A-level?
So the reason why I start required practicals with specific heat capacity is because students are already used to it from GCSE. It's not a completely new topic to them, so they are a bit more comfortable doing it. So normally how it starts is when we do the theory in the class, so they are familiar with the equation. So we have a sort of a discussion and we discuss through the various variables that we need to find specific heat capacity. I ask them to go home, do a plan, and come back for the next lesson. And the first lesson of the practical is a sort of a trial and error. So they come up with their plan. They know that C is equal to E over M delta theta. So we have a discussion. What are the things that you want to find? So what you should be keeping constant. And think about the method. Think about how long you should be heating the block for different time intervals so that we get a decent temperature change. I ideally tell them that something at least a 3 degree rise in temperature would be a decent increase in temperature, definitely not less than one. So we have all those discussions the first lesson when they come back with their plan. And then through trial and error, we have blocks of different masses with us. So I do purposely have different masses so that they can see that you end up getting the same specific heat capacity if the material is the same, mm-hmm. irrespective of what mass we use. So they do a trial and error and see what is the decent time slot for a proper increase in time. And so GCSEs, we give them a joule meter to measure the energy directly because according to the OCR specification, specific heat capacity comes in unit one, which is before they do current electricity. So we give them a joule meter to find the energy that goes to the block. Then in A-levels, we tell them you can't do that. You need to go a bit more deeper. So they go for the voltmeter, ammeter, so that they can have the current and the potential difference. And then they do the experiment. They heat it for a specific time. After every time interval, they find the change. They find the new temperature. And then they draw a graph of change in temperature against time. And then they put it into the equation and rearrange to find C. And once they do it with the solids, we generally tend to do it with water and oil also, just as a sort of an extension.
I have so many questions. Question number one, you say they do a graph. Now, when I do it, I do similar. I just give them, we teach it, and then they go away and plan it and do a risk assessment. And I say, right, go and do it. Mm-hmm. And none of them will draw a graph automatically. So do you steer them towards doing a graph
Yes, because they are comfortable taking just one value, plugging it in the equation.
Yeah, and exactly.
So that is where we try to bring the concept of accuracy there. Mm-hmm. And we always tell them A levels means advanced level. So you have to do something a bit more advanced than what you do for GCSE. So we then discuss about what is changing over the time, how can you bring that into the equation. So generally, yes, we have a discussion and then finally we decide what graph to draw.
So you give them a big steer, because what I do is I do that bad practical, they all just get a temperature rise, and I always, health and safety out there, people, I never let them go above 60 degrees. You don't really want a block there that's at 90 degrees, 100 degrees.
Definitely.
I will then say, right, that's one way of doing it. But you know, like you, it's advanced level. We need to do this better. We need to get an average. We need to be more accurate. And I will then introduce the idea of the graph. And then the next lesson, they do it properly. Like the next lesson, they'll either lag it, so it's properly insulated, because none of them insulated, which I think the insulation doesn't really matter if it goes a little bit above room temperature, but if they're taking it up to 60, you're actually...
Yeah, you're going to have appreciable cooling, aren't you? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. Now, how do you control the heat loss? Have you ever tried bringing them to the lab out of a freezer?
No, never.
Because I looked up this and I read that if you... So they come into the room fresh from the freezer at about minus 20. By the time you're set up, they're about minus 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go minus 10 to... room temperature at about 20, and then the same distance above room temperature, and theoretically the energy it takes in from the room should be equal to the energy it loses in the second half. So you should get a perfect result with no lagging. It's not what we found.
No, unfortunately, one thing I do remember is cooling is non-linear, so sadly.
Maybe I will try this, because after half term my year 12 class is going to do practicals, so maybe I will try this. But because of COVID restrictions, we don't have enough equipments for individual practicals as suggested, so we can't have a whole class individual practical at the same time. So we do have enough for 12 students, so we are splitting the class into two, and half the class will be doing the practicals and half the class will be consolidating using exam questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the next lesson, we are going to swap the groups.
Oh, good plan.
So maybe I should try this after.
So that was my first question. My second question was, I've only ever seen in all the schools, and it's quite a lot that I've worked in, you get a special milled block that is 1 kilogram. And it sounds like you don't have that. So tell me about your blocks.
We have actually, I think the smallest one we have is around 1,200 grams, in that range. We have three of them, which are quite heavy, which is above 2 kgs.
Mm. Well,
that's very handy, actually.
That's good. I love what you say about showing them that the mass doesn't change the specific heat capacity, which I can't do.
Yeah, no, that's not.
We have different masses.
Hmm. Now, that's very nice. One of the things that I really liked is you're sending them away to plan for this, because it's one of the things I always find quite difficult to address with students is the idea of range and interval of readings, you know, that they should be thinking about the range of readings that they're going to take and what intervals they should take beforehand. And it sounds like you kind of address that, because you're deliberately vague about how long they should be taking readings for. You say you need to look at, you know, a 3 degree centigrade rise minimum and things like that, but it's a great way of introducing, and it's quite an intuitive way of introducing the idea of what range and frequency of data you should take.
It is initially, to be honest, it is time consuming.
Mm.
It takes up a lot of our time, and the one advantage of that is by the time they reach towards the more than halfway through, I can see a sort of an accelerated response from quite a lot of students in the class.
Mm.
So initially it is time consuming, I should admit. And sometimes it depends. Sometimes depending on the experiment, it can turn out to be a bit frustrating also. But I think in the long run, they definitely benefit from that. My concept is it's fine to make mistakes. It's fine, because more than in according to my experience, the things that I remember more clearly now is more of the ones that I went wrong first.
Amen to that. No, that's absolutely true. It's one thing, actually, I know I do, because with practical work, because I always feel I'm sort of up against it in terms of time and rushing, that just sort of spoon feeding it rather than letting them make mistakes, letting them find their way, letting them feel their way. It's a tendency I have, and I know I should sort of slap myself over the wrist and tell myself to calm down. So it's good. That's a very good point.
Can I ask how you do specific heat capacity of liquids? Because I don't actually do that. I've never done that. I've never taken it there. Is it just as simple as popping a heater in a beaker of oil and doing it, measuring the temperature?
Yes, we don't make, because like as I said, time sometimes does become a factor. The only reason why I show them the liquid one also, because they can see that there are different methods there to make sure we are more accurate, we get more accurate values. For example, if it's a solid, they can't think about how to make the temperature uniform. But in the liquids, they can see that how they can make the temperature uniform by stirring and all those things. So it's just a beaker with a heater inside and a thermometer, and beaker fully lagged. And then the extra thing they would see is they will see that since it is a beaker with a liquid inside, there is a lid also for it.
Mm. And do you take into account the specific capacity of the container?
That we discuss. So when we ask them, so why is the answer different? So they mainly come up with things like, oh, the heat is low, energy is lost to the surroundings and things. Then we sort of initiate that discussion. Okay, so you are using the heater. What all things are you heating? So there are some, because we do have some really bright girls. Hmm. Sometimes what happens is, even so, when we ask this itself and they're doing the calculation itself, I have had girls coming up and asking me, Miss, shouldn't we consider the specific heat capacity of the beaker?
Yeah.
Then I'm like, wow, that's where I was going. Thank you. But sometimes that doesn't happen. But then when we discuss the heat loss, they say about going to the surroundings and all those things, then is that we initiate that conversation. So the heat coming from the beaker, just think what all it is heating up. So it does come up and that is another reason for doing liquids.
Yeah, no, that's nice. And I'll troll out my standard one of my lovely kettle, which I always like. And again, in COVID times, it's a nice one you can get them to do at home. Given that most kettles have a power rating on the bottom, you can, because of effectively a litre of water is 1 kilogram roughly, and because you can roughly say that the room temperature is about 22 degrees centigrade and the kettle turns off at 100 degrees centigrade, you can get a time for a particular temperature rise. And it's a very rough one, but it does come out with quite a decent value for the specific water.
That is nice. I have not thought about that.
Wait till Robin tells you you can measure the energy in a hydrogen bond using a kettle, using a very similar idea. That's one of Robin's favorite experiments.
It is my favorite. That's the one where you have the kettle. We had a kettle that we doctored so that it wouldn't stop boiling, and you basically you put it on a balance and you set it boiling, and then you can measure the change in mass over time.
Wow.
And again, you've got the power input for the kettle, so you can work out the bond energy of water from that, which is quite nice. So it's quite fun.
That's cool.
It's a bit of a digression.
I set that as homework once after you talked about it on the podcast, and I said you've got to hold the kettle down with a pen at the end of your arm. We don't want to get burnt. But they got pretty good results. But didn't we work out though that each OH minus makes several hydrogen bonds, so you have to divide it by 4 or something.
There's a factor in there. I think it's 2, as I recall, that basically on average a water molecule that's escaping has to break 2 hydrogen bonds, I think was the average. But yeah, so it was something like that. But it's not, like I say, not a bad go with a kettle at home. I always think it's pretty good go.
So back to specific heat capacity. Have you done method of mixtures? That's specifically mentioned in my spec, using method of mixtures.
No, we haven't done that. That's not mentioned in the spec.
Okay, so what I've done with that, and it's a nice, scary practical, is trying to measure the temperature of a Bunsen flame. Mm-hmm. So they have a piece of wire, steel wire, and they hold something made of steel or iron in the flame till it's absolutely as hot as it can be. And then they carefully, very carefully, drop it into a beaker of water and measure the temperature rise. And if they know the mass of the piece of iron and the specific capacity of the iron, they can actually work out the temperature change. Now, that is advanced. It's a lot of fun. That one's quite dangerous. You have to choose your class for that. Not done that?
I've done that one before. I do like it. It's quite a nice one. And again, it's a nice way of making them think through. I think a lot of the times, you know, they hit the theory, and I don't know if you find this, Rajani, but they sort of go through the pedestrian motions of the practical almost, and then sort of don't think about the theory. This is a really good way of challenging them. It's saying, okay, you know the specific heat capacity of iron, you know the specific heat capacity of water. So how can you tell the temperature of this Bunsen flame? You know, from this experiment, which we've described to you, you know, go think about it, think about how to do this, problem solve with it.
True. It is a really good extension activity for them.
Mm. It's good in AQA because we assess against CPAC, and there's a nice one where you can do a good risk assessment and then assess them against working safely. I've also tried boiling my box in a saucepan as a demo and then dunking those blocks in a liter of water and seeing the temperature rise and trying to work out the specific heat capacity of the block. That again didn't work super well because the temperature rise was tiny. There was so little energy in the block compared to the water. I think the temperature rise was about 3 degrees or something stupid, so the uncertainty was ridiculous. But I've tried. I like. I'm not mixed liquids. I was hoping one of you say, "Oh, I've tried mixing alcohol and water or something," but you haven't.
No.
Oh well, that's a shame. Well, I think we've touched on quite a lot of interesting specific heat capacity stuff there. But in the last podcast, Robin, you'll remember we trailed James De Winter.
James De Winter, yes, Mr. Birdsong.
I'm going to play you a chat that Robin had with James a couple of weeks ago, where he introduces a book, and I'm interested to know if either of you have heard of it.
Rather than kind of dig out an academic paper, I'm going to start by recommending a book, and the book's called Five Easy Lessons, Strategies for Successful Physics Teaching by Randall Knight. It's available in print in this country. It's not particularly expensive. And what it does, which I think is kind of unusual often in the research world, is it gives you a summary of some of what we know about students' understanding, and then it actually makes some specific suggestions about what to do in the classroom. And so other than a kind of introductory bit at the start about physics education research, the majority of the book is, about 15 sections covering areas of physics. Now, I would suggest that this book is probably really aimed at A-level physics teachers, but I think there are some ideas that you could get, you know, to conform and possibly improve the quality of the depth of your teaching, maybe your triple sciences or your GCSE, double award students. And so what I thought I'd do is I just offer a few quick highlights of the forces and Newton's law section, just so you can get a sense of how it's organized. So in the chapter, you know, he starts with what are the three basic issues that cause difficulties for students? What is a force? What is the connection between forces and motion? How a force is related when two objects interact? And then for the next couple of pages, he just goes through and summarizes from research that's been done in students' understanding about some of the conceptual difficulties students have. You know, they merge the word force, acceleration, velocity, momentum into one word, motion, and he talks a bit about the importance of language. So he kind of goes through and just offers a quick summary, and you get kind of a list of what you might call common misconceptions or alternative conceptions. You know, students don't believe Newton's third law, it's too contrary to common sense. Students have difficulty isolating systems from each other. Students have difficulty identifying action, reaction, force pairs. Some experienced teachers might know that, but it's sometimes quite helpful to be reminded of the things that students find challenging. And because it's written as a kind of commercial book, I think the language is more accessible because academic papers are often written for a particular audience. So he goes through there, a couple of pages of that. He'll then identify some things that you might want to teach students, some of which might be applicable to your course, some of which might not. And then he offers a direct pedagogical approach. He says, do this, do that. You know, so when it comes to the section about, you know, forces and motion problems, analyze the problem by having a pictorial representation, analyze the motion by drawing a motion diagram, identify the forces, use Newton's second law, work out what the vectors and the directions are. And again, you know, experienced teachers might go, yeah, I kind of do that, in which case, great. It's always nice to be reminded you're doing a good job. But actually, for those that are less confident or those that are less experienced or those that want to look back on their practice and just see, you know, just refresh and check they're happy with what they're doing, it's really good. And what I like about this book, I mean, I don't always agree with Randall Knight. It's not because I'm clever than him, because he's almost certainly cleverer than me, is that he tells a story. He says why he does stuff. And he sort of partly empowers me to have a different answer, because he said the problem, you know, this is what we know that these students struggle with. These are the difficulties they have. This is an answer. Have mine, or indeed think about what your own might be. So I'd say 5 easy lessons. Certainly if someone was brand new to teaching A-level physics, it would be a really good book to buy. And there's certainly even inexperienced physics teachers who might want to kind of look over their practice. Now, some of the topics in there are not relevant to even the A-level curriculum. There's a section on quantum physics that goes beyond there. But it's definitely a book worth having. You know, vectors, kinematics, Newton's law, momentum, energy, oscillations, waves, thermal physics, you know, there's still bread and butter stuff in there for all of us.
That's great. And it sounds like that with 15 sections, it's one of those books that you can pick up. You can zero in on the bit you're teaching next week. You can look at it and you can look at some practice there. And as you say, sort of maybe be challenged a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, for me, what matters is that we find ways to help us scrutinize and reflect our practice, ideally in a non-threatening way. We don't want to be told don't do that way. And I think what this book does, you know, it's only 10-15 pages per section, is it just says, oh, let's think about your teaching of mechanics together for a bit. I'll tell you what I think, and then you can think about what you think. Particularly if teachers are the only, you know, the physics teachers, the only one in the department, they may not be able to kind of spend half an hour talking about what's the best way to conceptualize momentum, because they've got no one to talk to about it.
So that's James, and on a new occasional spot on the podcast where James talks about a book or some research that he's come across. So anyone heard of that book? Anyone read that book? Rajani?
I haven't read that book, but recently we had gone for a training program where we were asked to write down the names of the books that they would recommend. And I do remember seeing this name in that list, 5 Easy Lessons. But because of COVID, the training got cancelled in between, and then I didn't get a time to go back and look at those books. But I have heard that name. And I remember coming home and checking Amazon for that. And then I did see that it had quite good reviews on Amazon.
So I remember it actually from my Institute of Physics days, because we gave a copy to... I think it was all of the scholars, all of the people who got a physics scholarship for training, got a copy, I think, one year. We gave that to them. And even then, I didn't manage to read any of it. But I do like it. I don't know. Where do you – I don't know if you – it's always a bit of a leading question. I want to phrase this carefully, Rajani, because I don't want you to feel under pressure. But the education research, I often find, you know, sometimes it's difficult to make the connection between the research and the classroom. And what I liked about this, and I think why James kind of selected it, was the idea of this is something that can actually give you some practical ideas to try. I don't know, is that something that appeals to you, or do you prefer your research a little bit more informative to your practice at a more abstract level?
No, I like, as you said, sometimes I have also felt the same. Some things look really good in writing, but it's difficult to bring that into practice. But I'm always like, I love reading books like this. So I might go for this and see how it is. Because that's why I said I looked into the reviews and I did see some really nice reviews for the book. So it was there in my to-do list sort of thing to get that book. But then, as I said, then everything, I just forgot about it completely.
Yeah. It's quite hard to chat about a book none of us have read, isn't it? But if it's as good as the ranking task book that he mentioned on the podcast, and which I did go and buy, and is fantastic, it will be well worth getting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I think these things, that there's always something, isn't there? There's always a nugget in there somewhere, isn't it? And this is kind of what we hope that the podcast brings as well. But there's always something that challenges your perspective, makes you think, oh, maybe if I tried that from a different angle, and it may work and it may not, but at least it challenges you to have a go at something a little bit different.
Exactly.
And I like what he says, that it reminds you what the kids don't know, because you forget. I've been teaching since 1852, and you forget what the kids don't know. You know, you think you know, but you don't know. And so I will probably be taking a look at that.
Mm. Yeah, no, I know that James is also a big fan of the diagnostic questions. These questions that sort of unearth or root out, if you like, children's popular misconceptions of various things. And I was doing this the other day with the classic misconception, and completely understandable, that for something to be moving, there has to be a force acting on it. Mm-hmm. And we literally did a thing with one of my classes where we sort of went through it and we looked at it and we talked about objects moving in space and we talked about friction and got through this sort of thing that's saying, so you're all happy that you don't have to have a force acting on something for it still to have a velocity, for it still to be moving. In fact, that's the natural state of things. They tend to carry on doing what they're doing until a force acts on them. Yeah. And then I literally put up a multiple choice slide the next thing saying, for something to move, it has to have a force acting on it, true or false. And loads of them just said, yeah, absolutely. It's true. And it's funny, and James alluded to this. He said these misconceptions, you know, that they're deep rooted and sometimes they take a long time to address. You know, even if, you know, at one level the students have said, yeah, okay, I accept that, they still believe. Yeah. They always do that.
I was teaching the resistors in parallel, you know, that equation, 1/R is 1/R, mm-hmm. R1, blah, yada, yada. And I said, and a really, really common error is that you do 1/R1 plus 1/R2 and you say, ha ha, that equals R. And yeah. I'm saying about half of you will make that mistake in the homework. No, we won't, they say. No, we won't. I've got them to stand up, put their hand in their heart and say, we promise to do the reciprocal of 1/R to get the final answer. But they will still do it, won't they? There's nothing you can do. They will still do it.
Yeah, when I teach the IV characteristics, I tell them very clearly that please don't say, when especially when you're doing diodes, please don't say that the gradient of the graph is resistance. Gradient of the graph is not resistance. And I tell them every year, I say this in the class, but still I will have at least 4 or 5 from the class who still writes, oh, the resistance is constant because it is the gradient there. And they say, no, miss, we will not. And definitely I can pick 4 or 5 again when I do the test who would have said the same thing.
It's a popular misconception.
It's a popular misconception. We did an episode on it, and I only ironed that misconception out 2 years ago, and I'd been teaching it my whole career. I'm so ashamed. And I now obviously don't teach it, and I taught it this year, and then I gave them a homework, and AQA know that they have that misconception. They had a VI graph, and the students drawn a tangent to the line. Which value from this graph is the resistance at 4 volts? And two out of 17 said the gradient. So it wasn't too bad, but
that's
still
not too bad.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading somewhere that there was an AQA question itself which was wrong. Oh yeah,
that's not that they had a very bad run a few years ago. They've been pretty good recently, though. Now, Rajani, I'm going to put you on the spot here, but you can think as long as you like, and you can say no. But when we have a guest, we like to ask them what their favourite demo or practical is, because one of the reasons we started the podcast was to encourage practical work. Mm-hmm. So you have time to think, that is there a practical or demo you, when your kids leave the school and go off into their lives and they think back fondly of your lessons, what is it? What practical or demo is it you want them to remember?
No, it's something that comes to my mind from a class practical that we did last year. It was a simple, that's nothing hi-fi or portionate. It was just one where we were discussing impulse, and we just had, we were just two girls, they were throwing eggs at each other. And
as you do.
As you do. Raw eggs?
Raw eggs, not even boiled. So I was asking the class to observe how they catch the eggs. So they could clearly see how they are lowering their hands to catch the eggs, which was automatically to increase the time and reduce the impact. And initially they were standing closer to each other. So definitely I made them wear lab coats and all those things, because as an accident can happen any time. And then I used to make them move further and further away from each other. It was a really fun, and I allowed the students to take pictures, and When I see them, some of them are not doing physics anymore for A-levels. But now, even now when they see them, when we talk about physics or the fun, what they had found interesting, they always will miss that egg drop experiment. Was amazing. We still love it.
That is fantastic, because I always struggle with the practical for impulse. That is fantastic. Well, that's such a gift. Well, wonderful.
It is an easy one to do, and it definitely depends on the class. But
yes,
it is an easy one to do. We don't need too many things, and they can easily see how their hand goes down, increasing the
time. It's nice, isn't it? It's one of those ones where they have an instinctive understanding of the physics, because they'll automatically start, you know, catching it high and taking their arms way down low, won't they? To as you say, lengthen the time and reduce the force that they're putting on the egg. And you say to them afterwards, why did you do that? And they'll have difficulty articulating why, but they will realize that the egg smashes, of course, if you don't do that. So it's kind of like they have the instinctive understanding of physics there, which I often make.
It's a bit of a cleaning after that, but it's fun.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I suppose, you know, if you're chicken like me, you could boil the eggs, I suppose, couldn't you?
Yeah, but I just actually, I might try. When I won't have time for cleaning, I might go for boiled eggs. But then this one, we just wanted to have some fun.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like a lovely one.
If there's no peril, it's not memorable. And eggs are amazingly robust. I remember when I was at university, the inevitable egg fight occurred on the common. And you can throw an egg as hard as you can, and it will skip hundreds of meters and it won't break. I mean, not all of them, but yeah, the odd one wouldn't break. You couldn't believe how hard you threw it, and then someone would run and pick it up and throw it back at you.
No, they're really interesting. I mean, because the thing is, if you get the eggs and you put them all upright, you know, you can stand on them, because they are incredibly robust in one particular direction, but then not in another. So if you put them sort of long ways with a pointed bit at the top, they're incredibly strong. But then, of course, if you put them sideways and step on them, they will break immediately. So they're an interesting structure.
And there's a fantastic misconception about eggs, isn't there, that on the full moon, in a leap year or something, you can stand them. You can stand them up on their pointy end. There's some weird myth. I've seen YouTube videos about it. And in fact, any egg, any time of day, you can stand it up on its end if you take your time. Because they're all not perfectly smooth. They all stand up on their end. Anyway, that's not physics. That's just rubbish. Well, Rajani, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I'm so glad you saw that tweet and replied. So thank you very much. I hope you'll come on again.
Thank you so much. It was a really good experience. I'm taking some things for my class from here. So I'm really happy that I made the choice to come.
Well, I hope we'll add you to our listener list. And thank you very much, Robin.
Thanks indeed, Thomas. I'll catch you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast, and special thanks this week to Rajani Nair and friend of the podcast, James De Winter. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas WP, and Robin Griffiths, and produced and edited by me, Thomas WP, with Robin doing the show notes. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you in a couple of weeks, because next week is half term in the UK. So if you're on half term, we hope you have a wonderful and well-earned break. You deserve it.